In 1872, the United States Supreme Court denied Myra Bradwell the right to practice law specifically because she was a woman. Miss Bradwell apprenticed, passed the Illinois bar exam, and had support from legal professionals. But the decision to deny her the right to practice law rested on the idea that women were, quote, never contemplated, unquote, to be members of the bar. Things have changed since then, but not without the sacrifice and fortitude of female lawyers. In our first two seasons, we met with a dozen or so female jurists who talked about their backgrounds and paths to get on the bench. This season, we'll expand on those stories and interview lawyers throughout the state of Florida who are trailblazers in their practice areas and role models for male and female attorneys everywhere. Welcome to another episode of Never Contemplated. I'm your host, Hetal Desai. Today, we continue our series on bar sections with a focus on attorneys who are leaders in their field. As we previously discussed, the Florida Bar has 23 sections and divisions, focusing on a variety of subject areas. And this year, we hope to bring you interesting interviews with the people who serve in each of these sections. Florida is known as a no-fault state for divorce and ranks in the top five states in the United States. Although rates of divorce have steadily decreased over the past 10 years, the number of family lawyers has not. In 1991, a Florida Supreme Court commission recommended the creation of family courts or divisions in each circuit. The goal was for families to be able to have all of their disputes resolved by one judge if practical, and to ensure the cases were handled in the most effective and efficient ways possible. The Florida Bar Family Law Section has over 4,000 members with 24 committees. The section hosts a number of workshops and CLEs, educating lawyers and judges about the various aspects of family law, including financial, emotional, and child custody issues. Today, we are going to learn a little bit about the latest concepts on dealing with dissolution and related issues. We'll also learn what it's like to be a family lawyer. We're joined by Sarah E. Kay, who serves as the current chair of the Family Law Section, and Shannon Novy, the current treasurer of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, which we'll refer to as AAML. Ms. Kay is a sole practitioner in Tampa who graduated from Stetson University with both her law degree and a master's of business administration. Ms. Novy graduated from Florida State University College of Law and is the managing partner of Novy & Gonzalez, a boutique firm in Tallahassee. Both attorneys are board certified in marital and family law and are fellows of the AAML. Both also speak regularly on family law issues and topics and the topic of professionalism. Both attorneys have also received numerous awards, including pro bono service awards and recognition by Super Lawyers Magazine. Welcome, ladies, and thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Okay, Sarah and Shannon, before we dive into a discussion of family law and why you practice it, I want to give a warning and full disclosure to our listeners that Shannon Novy is one of my oldest friendors, as Judge Costello has called it on this podcast. And so this episode could go anywhere and may need a lot of editing.
Silliness could certainly ensue.
We're going to start at the beginning, as we always do. And Sarah, I'm going to start with you. You both practice family law, but you both come from different backgrounds. You practice in different ways. So I'm going to explore all of those things today. Sarah, you practice in Tampa, but you're a transplant into Florida. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
I am. I'm originally from a very small town in Massachusetts in the middle of the state. And I moved here to Tampa in 2006.
And did you move here because of the weather? Is that what you told me before?
Yeah, mainly, yes. I was going to say that, and my husband is a Tampa native, so that heavily influenced where we ended up.
I know that Shannon's family is from Florida, and she has, I don't know, many generations, three generations in Tallahassee?
On my dad's side, yeah. My grandmother was born in Live Oak. And moved here after World War II with my grandfather. And a Tallahassee native, like for reals.
Sarah, so you came down back with your husband to Tampa. But before that, you grew up in Massachusetts, but your family were educators. They weren't lawyers, right?
Yeah, that's right. My father was a 30-plus year veteran teaching culinary arts in a vocational public school in Lexington, Massachusetts. My mother also taught phys ed for a period of time, but then when my brother and I were born, she ended up switching over to become a children's room librarian in the public library downtown.
So you probably were well-fed, well-read, and physically active?
Yes. A majority of my childhood was spent in the children's room in our public library.
And I know that from your resume that you actually practice as a teacher yourself. Is that right?
Yep. I taught in middle school and high schools in Massachusetts for about 5 years before switching over to law.
And Shannon, where did you go to undergrad?
I started my undergrad at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Did you notice that I skipped right over high school? Because I know I know all about
she
that.
She doesn't want to know any stories about high school. I grew up in Tallahassee. I went and started my undergraduate life at George Mason, which in the year that I graduated high school, and I won't say what year that was written up as like one of the, you know, Time Magazine's 10 best buys in a public education, and was happy enough there, but broke my ankle ice skating on Freedom Plaza in downtown DC, moved back here to recuperate and met my husband and ended up transferring to Florida State. So,
well, unlike Sarah, both of your parents are attorneys.
Not just that, but step parents too. You know, like it was really, I was sort of.
So you went into the family business.
I went into the
literally.
Literally.
Yes. And we're going to get there in a minute. But you both also have in common that you didn't go straight into law school after undergrad. You both worked. Sarah, you worked as a teacher. Tell us a little bit about that.
I taught Spanish in middle school and high school, and that's because I was an exchange student my senior year in high school and then again my junior year in college.
And do you think that I'm sure practicing in Tampa and in Florida that the Spanish has helped you deal with your clients? Is that true?
Very much so.
Yeah. So we have interpreters when we have court. I often thought that we should have a CLE for Spanish for lawyers because I've never seen that. Hint, hint, Florida bar. But I think that would be great. What do you think about that, Sarah?
Absolutely.
Would you be willing to teach a class, or do you think it's difficult to teach lawyers?
I don't think it's difficult at all. In fact, the majority of the lawyers that I have met are just lifelong learners. They're just information sponges.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Shannon, you did not teach, but you worked in government.
For ACCA, yeah.
For ACCA, right?
Yeah. So when I graduated from college, I wasn't ready to accept that I was going into the family business. And I took a job as a research assistant on a Robert Wood Johnson grant, and then later moved into the executive office and worked as a legislative aide at the Agency for Healthcare Administration. And I did that for a couple of years and then accepted my fate and went to law school.
And you went to law school at Florida State, right? So
I
you
did.
Stayed in Tallahassee.
I did.
Sarah, where did you graduate from? Stetson, right?
That's Stetson, yep.
And you actually went into the part-time program, right?
I did. When I first moved down here, just from my background in education, I knew that the best teacher was just life experience. I mean, that's how I'd taken Spanish classes in middle school and high school myself, but it was a completely different world going down to a native Spanish country. And so I wanted to replicate that experience with law. So I ended up landing a job at a local law firm and then attending Stetson part-time.
And was the law firm a family law firm?
It was. It was Sessions Black in Tampa, which is a boutique marital and family law firm. And I was very fortunate to end up there because that very heavily shaped my future.
And you ended up staying at the firm, right, after you graduated?
I did.
Shannon, you ended up going back to DC after you graduated. Is that right?
Right. My first law job was with the firm where I had clerked in law school, the no longer existing Hopping Green law firm. And then I went to Washington with my husband while he pursued his PhD and did something completely different before I moved back to Tallahassee, I think in 2007, and started practicing family law with my dad. So I had, I don't know, 5-6 years of law practice under my belt before I became a family lawyer.
And you didn't practice family law. You practiced business. I don't know, bankruptcy. I don't even know what kind of law that was.
It was ERISA and bankruptcy. And weirdly, I ended up having like this really super subspecialty in airline bankruptcies, airlines that had big pension plans that, and they were all kind of going down around us during those years.
Well, did any of that practice help you, or does it help you in your family law practice?
Yeah, for sure. It, you know, it's about financial matters. And one of the principal areas for the court to adjudicate in a family law case is the marital estate, which, you know, sounds simple enough, right? You're going to take the assets and liabilities that are accumulated during the marriage and divide them in half. But Sarah and I can both tell you that there's a lot more to it than that. So it was a really good introduction to litigation about financial matters, to, you know, a code-based form of practice, the bankruptcy code and the federal ERISA code. And, you know, there are lots of differences too between having a corporate client and an individual as a client, but it was helpful.
Sarah, you graduated and ended up working at the same firm. What kind of work did you do in Tampa at family law? Was it litigation? Was it appellate?
Yeah, the Sessions Black does trial work predominantly. However, we did take on a handful of appeals on occasion. And my practice at Sessions Black, and that really just is where I ended up landing, was it ended up being a blend, you know, some collaborative law, some trial work.
Let's define that, because I keep seeing that, and I've never heard of collaborative law in any other field except for family law. What does that mean?
Collaborative law is when both parties and their attorneys and the neutrals that get hired all sign an agreement saying, we're going to do our best to try to work this out outside of court. And if it works into an agreement, fantastic. If it doesn't, then with very limited exception, everyone parts ways and the case has to start over again, pretty much from scratch in the litigation realm, which gets, it's a very high stakes in the sense that, you know, for people to go into collaborative law, they need to be committed to come to an agreement, because to start over can extend the process and have a financial impact on the family.
And when you say neutrals, what do you mean?
Typically in collaborative cases, there's going to be a neutral facilitator, someone who's hired to, usually it's a mental health professional, though it doesn't have to be.
So it's not an arbitrator or a mediator. No. It's something different.
No, they're truly a facilitator. They're going to go in and work with the parties just one-on-one, like with the parties directly. And then also, when we have big group meetings, they run the meeting and run the agenda. And then there's also a neutral financial professional, and it could be a CPA or a CFP, a certified financial professional. And that person's going to work with the parties to get all the financial documents and information and help create schedules and run calculations.
And what kind of clients, maybe Shannon, you can both answer, what kind of, it's not meant for everybody, right? What kind of clients would benefit from the collaborative process?
I think people that one of the really big advantages of it is that it is the privacy that can be maintained. You know, there's very little filed in the court file. So people who wish to maintain their privacy over their personal matters and their financial matters get an advantage there. And people who really want to, or see the value, I guess, in some self-determination and not being derailed, not so much by the lawyers, but by the adversarial process that we all engage in when we're in litigation. So it's just an alternative mechanism to resolving the disputes that arise in the dissolution of marriage. And one of the things that we do to ensure that it'll work is have those potential clients meet with that neutral facilitator to really do a deep dive into what their goals are, what the client's goals are, and try to make an assessment about whether those goals are compatible to be resolved in a non-adversarial process.
Well, it sounds like it also is an expensive process. So it's not for everyone.
It's less expensive than litigation.
It is. And I also talk to my clients when we're exploring that option about fee shifting, because the attorneys tend to take a little bit more of a backseat role to that process. In a well-run collaborative process, the parties are going to be primarily working with the neutral facilitator to try to work out like parenting plan issues, and then the neutral financial professional to get the financial issues. And then they're going to be bouncing questions off of the attorneys. And I say that typically the neutrals bill at a lower hourly rate. And so the attorneys end up serving a lot more as almost like a resource, a true advisor capacity, as opposed to being at the forefront of making arguments.
So you're more helpful than beating up each other. Is that?
It really requires the lawyers, I think, more than anybody else in the process, to develop a different skill set, because we have to sort of deprogram the training that we've all had about zealous advocacy and all of, you know, what we think should happen, and really try to let clients be the decision makers about how they are going to meet their goals.
Well, I guess I just wonder if, I mean, they've gotten to a point where they haven't been able to be collaborative about life. So how is it that they can do this when they're at their end, you know, their wits' ends? I don't know. Well, I mean, that's probably
a different discussion.
I'm not a skeptic. I think I need to see it in work, and I'm sure that qualified people can make it work.
Truthfully, if you ask the, at the risk of getting in trouble by calling my dad an old timer, if you ask the old guys and gals,
old school, let's call them
old school. Yes. The sages, they will say that it's what good lawyers do. I mean, you know, nobody wants to be in court, even in a traditional litigated case. If there's a reasonable solution that isn't going to be court imposed, right? If it's obvious to everyone, we try not to go to the courthouse, and it's way better for people, as Sarah said, on children's issues.
What other traits do you think are conducive to becoming a family lawyer? Well, I guess let's first talk about what other things what you do. So we know you do divorces, custody. What other things are involved? You know, financial issues. I mean, it seems like it touches a lot of things. It's like an octopus.
It does. And that's one of the things I love about family law, is that it's a very broad scope of issues that we get to work with. It can be anywhere from contract negotiation, because we have premarital agreements or marital settlement agreements or paternity settlement agreements, to contract interpretation, enforcement. There's also torts. We'll have torts come up in some instances. We have people that work with, they have closely held businesses. So then we end up with business issues, business valuation issues.
Tax.
Thank you. Tax. Shannon, feel free to jump in anywhere.
I mean, it really is the panoply of legal issues that you can think of, because we're serving clients who are individuals. And that's what I love about it, is that it's so interesting. And I think you have to be interested in people, but to hear their stories, to learn about their niche businesses, all the ways that people, you know, arrange their lives, both, you know, from a relationship perspective and from a business perspective, are really interesting. And trying to figure out how to parse out those issues in a way that is consistent with the principles of Chapter 61 and of, you know, all the rest of the law that we're constrained by is really challenging and interesting. No day is the same.
Just when I think I've learned everything, something else will come up in a case.
Well, it seems like that practitioners that do family law don't belong to big firms. They are either solo practitioners like you, Sarah, or small firms like you, Shannon. Why do you think that is?
There's something about the economics of big law, but I don't fully understand, but I think that's part of it.
Well, that, and also for me, it's a very personal matter. A family law case really touches at people's core. It's their lives that we're working with. I feel like that's a lot more conducive to solo and small firm practitioners because, you know, maybe this is just me, but I walk into a large law firm, I suddenly start feeling a little bit like a number, but versus working one-on-one with someone where you know who the paralegal is and they've been there for a long time and who the attorney is. And you get a lot more when you're in the solo and small firm realm, you get a lot more personalized attention. And I feel like that's kind of a little bit more conducive to how people feel about their family law case.
Well, I know, Sarah, that you are the chair of the family law section this year. What steps did you take to get there? Why did you want to take leadership role in the bar?
I like to some extent, simply me being a part of Sessoms Black, it became part of my destiny. Sessoms Black had Steve Sessoms, was one of the founding partners, and actually the founding partner. And he was a two-time chair of the family law section when it was first starting. He's one of the first two chairs. Then also Miriam Mason, who's his law partner. She's a past chair. Caroline Black-Sikorsky is also a past chair. And then the other partner over there that I worked with was Alex Caballero, and he was very active within the family law section. He decided to opt for different leadership opportunities. And so I started attending family law section functions before I was even an attorney. I started at Sessoms Black as a receptionist, then a file clerk, and then a legal assistant. And when I hit that legal assistant status, the firm started sending me to section events. And once I became an attorney, it was I love committee work. You know, some people knit, some people crochet. I do committee work for fun. I know it sounds completely nerdy, but I own it and I love it.
All I can think about is I'm sorry, Sarah, but all I can think about is the Breakfast Club where they say demented and sad, but social.
Right. So, and I love the people in the section. I really do. I consider a lot of them friends and all of them colleagues, and it's just a great organization to be a part of. And it's truly been an honor and a privilege to chair the section this year. And I've just had a lot of fun with it.
Shannon, you, I don't know if you have anything to add about the bar section.
No, I mean, thank God for Sarah and the people who step up to run the section. They do an amazing job of providing all kinds of opportunities for continuing education and made a lot of friends around the state and learned a lot through my work with the section.
Shannon, you're also very active in the AAML. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the AAML is an organization that promotes professionalism and ethical conduct in the practice of family law. Every attorney who is a fellow in the academy must be board certified as a prerequisite for admission into the organization. And it really just provides, you know, the most stringent ethical and professional standards for all of its members. And it, in conjunction with the section, has provided so many opportunities for leadership and learning for me. And it's a really wonderful organization.
Well, I know when I have had family and friends that need a divorce attorney in other states, I always call you and you always say, let me look that up.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Is that right?
Yes. And so it, you know, in addition to all those wonderful professionalism and things, it is a way to provide assistance to people across the country. And we receive referrals in the same way.
Well, we talked a little bit about collaborative, which we jumped ahead in my questions, but I want to talk about something else. What does it mean to be a no-fault state? And if we're no fault, why do we need attorneys to figure out whose fault it was? Sarah? Well,
the dissolution of a marriage, which a lot of people colloquially call divorce, in the past years, way back when, in order to get a divorce, you had to prove some sort of fault, like as in this person cheated on me, or oh, this person was married to three other men at the time that they married me. And Florida did away with that, all that finger pointing, and just said, hey, listen, all we need is one person to come in and say under an oath that the marriage is irretrievably broken. And that's more than enough. So we can just get past that part. But typically when you go to divorce, it's not just we need to like dissolve the marriage. We also have kids and we have assets and we need to figure out how to divide everything up. And so that's why we need the attorneys, is to help advise as to what your rights are and what your options are in figuring out all the extra stuff beyond just the initial divorce itself.
And I know that that is not true in every state. Is that right? That other states, they still have fault?
Other states have fault. Other states have year-long waiting periods. Some other states have jury trials for a divorce, which would be really wild.
Your peers decide things about your personal thing.
Yeah. Who's right and who's wrong.
Well, another question that I have, and I think, Shannon, you've testified at the legislature about alimony bills and things like that. What's the status of the latest legislature? We're in session right now.
This session was relatively quiet on the family law front. There was a bill that has passed out of both houses of the legislature, and I don't know, has it been signed yet, Sarah?
I haven't heard anything.
I don't think it has been, but there was a bill to clarify some things on equitable distribution, which is the sort of the first financial issue that we deal with in divorce cases. And that's a very positive thing. Last year, there were revisions to the alimony statute. The bill basically eliminated what used to be called permanent periodic alimony. So permanent didn't really mean permanent. It just meant a periodic stream of payments with an uncertain duration. And that's no longer available in family law cases. And instead, there were some limits put in place on the duration of alimony. So there are sort of a framework about how long it can last in new cases. And then some other changes that dealt with not to get too into the weeds on the substance of it, but that dealt with trying to put not a guideline, but some limits around the amount as well.
Okay. Well, the test is over. Now I've quizzed you on all of my family law questions. Sarah, we had talked about before something new in the court system that your bar section was working with OSCA, which is Office of
State Courts Administrator,
about trauma-informed. I'm not sure what the terminology is. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
What?
Would you like me to talk about it?
Yeah. Tell us what what they're calling it and what it is, the program.
Yeah. I'm absolutely thrilled that this year, for the first time ever, the Office of State Courts Administrator is partnering with a section from the bar, so the family law section. And together, we're jointly presenting a series of 11 workshops throughout the state on trauma-informed and trauma-responsive courts. And, you know, I let me use an easy example, kind of turning the Wayback Machine, before we had drug courts and veteran courts, someone gets into a battery incident and they go in and, oh, you hit this person. Shame on you. Here's your punishment. We're done. But through trainings and trauma responsiveness and becoming trauma informed, the courts were saying, wait a second, why did you hit this other person? Oh, you were high on drugs. Well, let's talk about that. Let's see what kind of resources within the community we can partner you with so that you're not going to come back, that this isn't going to happen again. And that's been true, like within the dependency courts, within the criminal courts, the concept of being trauma informed and having trauma responsive courts has been around for quite a few years. It's never been embraced. I mean, it's been embraced a little bit, but not fully within the family law, the domestic relations courts. And so together, the family law section and OSCA are partnering to push forward that initiative so that our courts and our practitioners can become trained. And a lot of times these types of trainings happen in silos where, the courts get their training, the attorneys might get a CLE on it, but we've never brought everyone together all at once to talk about it and get the training together to facilitate a dialogue. And that's what's so unique about this initiative. We've already put on 4 of the 11 events. We have 2 more in March, 3 in April, and then the last 2 in June. And we're already seeing fruits of that labor up in Jacksonville as a direct result of our workshop that we held up there. The court opened up a dedicated room for children that get brought in by their parents when they're going to domestic violence courts. People aren't supposed to bring their kids they do. It's a reality. And now the court has that room so that it's going to hopefully reduce the trauma of a child getting dragged into court so that they're in a kid-friendly room and an environment with trained individuals to care for them.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see all the changes that occur. And I wonder if they're going to monitor or track, you know, the results. I don't even know how you would do that, how that would affect other people's lives. Both of you have won pro bono service awards. Shannon, your firm started or helped start something called Thunderdome. And I don't know if that's just local or if that is statewide, but tell us a little bit about that.
The Thunderdome was a project with Legal Aid to provide mentoring for, you know, a lot of the cases that come through the Legal Aid office are people in need of family law services. And, you know, I was just reading something the other day that's not really a pro bono point, but about middle class families and the cost of divorce. So, you know, it is an issue if you're gonna, not everybody can afford it. And there's lots of need for the services. So the Thunderdome was a program that we dreamed up to provide mentoring and teaching for young lawyers and other lawyers too, to feel confident about taking on a legal aid case and to get some mentoring from an experienced family law attorney in doing so. So there's a series of lectures that each class goes to about the sort of basics of family law and the issues that they might confront. And then each participant is paired with a mentor and they take a case from Legal Aid and they take it all the way through the process. So it's been very successful.
Sarah, tell us a little bit about your pro bono work that you did. And I think it's after you started your own firm, right?
It's been throughout my career. And again, I just have so much.
I meant that you got the award recently.
I did get the award afterwards. But yeah, but I, again, it goes back to the mentors that I had at Sessions Black. Caroline Black Sikorsky also received the Florida Bar President's Pro Bono Award for her service. And it just, quite frankly, it was part of my blood and part of my training to continue that legacy. So yeah, I did. Oh God, when was it? I remember that it was because of COVID. I couldn't actually go to Tallahassee to receive my reward. I got it through YouTube. It's kind of a fun experience. So it was around 2020. And yeah, I've taken on Hague Convention cases, pro bono, and a wide variety of family law cases, from just a simple divorce to, I had one case that was a divorce and two additional paternity actions all bundled into one.
And what would you tell attorneys out there, especially new attorneys, about? I know I was always afraid to take a pro bono case that I knew nothing about, you know, that was outside my expertise of law. But those are the kind of pro bono cases that are needed. A lot of family law cases come up. What would you tell an attorney why they should be able to do that?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, most of the legal aid organizations, I know we have Bay Area Legal Services here in Hillsborough, and most of the legal aid organizations, if you pick up a pro bono from them, they'll partner you with experienced family law attorneys who are willing to mentor you. I've done that.
That's what the Thunder
times.
That's the Thunderdome concept, right? About helping attorneys help other people.
That's right.
Yeah.
That, and then the family law section has a very active mentoring program. You can go right on our website and find people that will volunteer to mentor you from a case from beginning to end.
I want to switch now. We've been jumping kind of all over the place, but I want to talk to each of you about your law practices, the business kind of part of it. But Shannon, I want to talk to you. You went into your family business. What was it like? I guess I think you're the first person that I've interviewed that actually went into business with a family member. Your dad was, you know, Novi Law. He had been practicing in Tallahassee for years. Everyone in town knows him. Tell us what it was like to join and start doing something new.
Yeah. So
that was like 2007, right?
2007. And I graduated from law school in 1999. So my father, one of the things is that he definitely knows how to play a long game. he had to figure out how to replace himself in his law practice. Anyway, he finally sort of hit me at a point in my life where it seemed like it made sense. And, you know, I don't know that I would have totally loved cutting my teeth as an absolute baby lawyer with a family member like that. But I had enough confidence about my abilities and skills to go ahead and do it. And it was really quite a joy. I mean, for me to get to relate to a parent, you know, in a different kind of way. We have, you know, a close relationship because of just years of practicing law together on top of the rest of our personal relationship. So it was a great joy to me. And interestingly, there are quite a few families within the family law section that Sarah and I both know that have, you know, parent child relationships within their law firms. So I don't know if it's a, you know, the family business thing seems to apply in family law. You know, I could see how with different personalities, it wouldn't be so great, but it worked out just fine for us. And, you know, occasionally after a hard day, I'll say to him that I thought that he loved me, but apparently not, you know, but no, it was a nice move to be back home and to be in my hometown in a place where I had the community available to me. And I don't know, that wasn't a very coherent answer, but
no, it was lovely. And Jerome, we'll call it Jerome Novi, gave me my first legal job, which was a runner for a law firm. So that was, I don't know, my first year in college or
something.
He
totally takes credit whenever we go to Judge Desai's family events for her judginess.
He is an incredible mentor for sure. Sarah, I wanted to ask you about your being a solo practitioner. I mean, I think you don't have any other paralegals or anybody that help you.
Nope.
What made you want to take that leap from having, you know, being a small firm, but a firm, to going out on your own?
It was a very, very hard decision. When I gave my resignation, I like legit cried because I never thought it would happen.
Well, it's a scary proposition.
It is. That, and in all sincerity, Sessions Black was a family to me. I'd been there for 13 and a half years. I'm a lover. I'm not a fighter. And I can do litigation. I'm good at it, but it's not where my passions lie. It doesn't fill my proverbial emotional bucket. My bucket gets filled by helping other colleagues and being a lot more truly collaborative. And so when I hung my own shingle, I slowly phased out the litigation portion of my practice. I do research and writing on a contract basis with attorneys throughout the state. And I'll also do litigation support. I've come in and second chaired larger trials for other solo and small firm practitioners. I provide mediation services and guardian ad litem services. And then I will take on the occasional collaborative case.
Hey, I want to say this too about practicing, you know, coming home and practicing law and mentorship is that, you know, I was lucky that my mother was also a lawyer and a woman in business. And I think that,
yes, let's not forget your mom.
Yeah. She provided a lot of modeling for me about how to sort of take the knocks that that come along when you're in charge of your own destiny, meaning, you know, you're supporting yourself, you're supporting the people who work for you and representing your clients. And, you know, it's a lot of responsibility. And I had a lot of good modeling there too.
Yeah. We'll give a shout out to Alicia as well. So I think you probably hear this a lot, and I probably have said it to all the family lawyers that I know, that I don't think I could do it, just because I think, Sarah, you called lawyers as educational sponges that we just love to learn, but we also have a hard time not absorbing our clients, you know, their emotions and how that affects us. And so I want to talk to each of you about how you deal with that and maybe talk about self-care, wellness. You know, we talk a lot about wellness on this podcast. I don't know if it helps anyone, but anyway, Sarah, let me start with you. What is it that you do, or how do you not get so absorbed in the problems of others?
I agree with you that it takes a certain temperament to be a very effective family law attorney, because I liken it to, if you're a personal injury attorney, you know, Joe hits Susie with the car. Joe and Susie are strangers. They may be even from different states. And once they're done, that's it. They're not going to interact with each other. We, on the other hand, are working with individuals where, you know, especially when they have kids, that they're going to be interacting with each other for the rest of their lives. And you have to handle that with care, because the what you're doing and the advice you're giving is going to impact not just your client, but an entire family and oftentimes children and generations to come. You're going to be part of stories that are being told around the campfire, or, you know, stories that people are telling to their therapists. So you have to be really cognizant of that. And that's where I say I'm a lover. I'm not a fighter. And so I had to be very, like, I had to be honest with myself about my own mental health and making sure I took care of myself and that I was using my skill set in a way that I could sleep at night. And so that's where me helping other attorneys and being that support network and helping families creatively problem solve through mediation or through my guardian ad litem work, I feel like, you know, I'm doing a lot more of a force of good than being in court making arguments. I can, I will, but it's just that. And then also the other thing that I make the joke about my committee work, but that truly is an emotional bucket filler for me, because I feel like I'm collaborating with my peers to create a better world for my colleagues and for the Florida's families through the work that I'm doing with the Florida Bar. And that's why I've had a couple of people say, Sarah, you light up like a Christmas tree when you talk about this OSCA. And I'm like, yeah, how cool is that? The positive work that we're doing that hopefully is going to have a systemic positive impact, that helps me sleep at night.
Yeah, you're pretty lit up like a Christmas tree right now. I can see it on the screen.
I know, she was. She got all bright and shiny.
How about you, Shannon?
You know, you guys have both said it. You have to be able to remind yourself like a mantra, you know, I didn't create the problem. I'm doing my best to help unravel the knot, but it wasn't my doing, you know, and to not take on those problems as your own. I think, you know, all the sort of obvious things humor, I think, is an important, you know, part of it.
Sarah's nodding her head.
Not that we're making fun of people or making light of their problems, but, you know, a little bit of humor goes a long way. Taking time out, not taking on cases that you don't have the capacity to actually deal with in a timely manner or that you just don't want to do. You know, I think that surrounding yourself with staff and colleagues that are not problem people and trying to sort of be really judicious about the people that you help, because if you want to do it, if you have a passion for helping them, it makes it better. If it's somebody that you just don't think that you can accomplish their goals or you don't want to accomplish their goals, just not stepping into that void.
Well, I know that both of you have taken a lot of time. So I just want to...
I want to know like what the craziest thing you've ever valued is, Sarah.
Valued like you personally have valued?
No. So part of what we do is when we're dividing the asset, that includes everything that you might think is an asset, like, you know, like think Steve Martin, like all I need is this lamp,
like a dog,
you know,
or a cat,
like a dog or a cat or a.
I know people fight over that when I was at the first DCA, I think there was an opinion about it.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely dog opinions.
Yeah. So one of the things I will say about family law attorneys is that even though Shannon and I have been good friends, she's very discreet. So I never get any details, even that she's representing someone that we both know in common. I won't know that. I may never know that unless that person tells me. So I'm surprised she wants you to divulge some. Well, I know you're both active in your bar sections. Is there anything else that you would encourage young attorneys to do if they want to do family law, or besides maybe join the section, or is there, you know, maybe take on legal aid? I can't think of anything else.
Definitely join the family law section and make use of our mentoring program. And when you show up, you don't have to jump right in and volunteer for 87 things, simply showing up and getting to know the other people around you, interacting with other lawyers on a regular basis. I can't say enough good things about it, because those relationships become your lifelines in so many ways, emotionally and professionally and ethically. So I can't stress enough. And some people, I don't have time to network. I'm like, it's not about networking. It's about building relation. It's relationship building. And I've lost count of the number of people that I can count as mentors from within the family law section. I'm also past president of the Hillsborough Association for Women Lawyers, another phenomenal organization. Shout out to FALL, which is the statewide organization, and then all the local chapters, the AML as well. So just being active, getting to know the other people, you can't put a price tag on it.
Chin, anything to add?
I think, you know, relationships are really imperative. And that's what Sarah's talking about. She's right.
Before we leave, let me ask each of you, if you had one piece of advice for a new attorney, what would it be? Shannon?
I tell young lawyers all the time to stop telling people that they went to law school because they're bad at math.
For me, it's always remember that family law is truly about the family. It's not just all about your client. And sometimes when people are stuck in the emotional throes of being involved in a family law case, they lose sight of that, and they develop tunnel vision, and they need their attorney to remind them to keep their eye on the prize, which is the family is the foundation of our society and the foundation of their life.
All right. Thank you, ladies, for your time. It really was fun.
It was. Thanks for having us.
Definitely. Appreciate it.
I want to thank the Latimer Center for Professionalism for supporting this podcast. I also want to thank the center's director and staff, Rebecca Bandy, Katie Young, Clay Shaw, John Siegel, and Sapphire Austin, for all their work in organizing, recording, and making us sound great. Finally, the information provided during this podcast is not intended to constitute legal advice. If you have questions regarding dissolution, custody, child support, or any other legal matters, you should consult a licensed attorney. The views expressed by our guests are in their individual capacities and should not be deemed to represent the Center of Professionalism or the Florida Bar.